Good morning and welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The American Southwest is a land that echoes with mystery, stark beauty, and a history of brutality. On this arid landscape, civilizations have risen and fallen for thousands of years. Some were wiped out by changing climatic conditions, others by the brutality of Spanish conquistadors, and later by American settlers and military. Yet the remnants of these complex societies remain and have fascinated visitors to the Southwest for centuries. This morning, we talk with William DeBuys, who's co-author of First Impressions, A Reader's Journey to Iconic Places of the American Southwest, about how the past and present come together more vividly in the hard, dry beauty of the Southwest than in any other part of America. Bill, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. It's good to be with you.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about why we're having this show at this time when it's like I feel like this has been some of the hardest few weeks that a lot of people in this country and the world have gone through between the devastating hurricanes and flooding in the southeast, the mammoth wildfires here in the west, flooding in Asia, fear of going to war with North Korea, and the escalating terror against immigrants here in the United States, particularly those from south of the border. Why do you think it's relevant that we talk today about these iconic landscapes in the Southwest, even more than that, the disappeared civilizations that they represent?
Well, a couple of things. Being aware of our history is a way to prepare ourselves to deal with our present, it seems to me. And to be able to see the longer themes, the overarching, the meta themes that connect past and present helps us deal with the complexities that we have to confront on a daily basis. The other side of the coin is that, in a sense, the civilizations of the past in the Southwest haven't really disappeared. They've metamorphosed into tribal lives of the present. And in a way, the Southwest, as much or more than any other part of the country, is a monument to cultural survival and persistence. I think one of the greatest stories of the Southwest is the fact that it still has a native life in the Pueblos and the Apache tribes, the Navajo, the Tohono O'odham, and other groups that persist strongly into the present.
Well, one of the things you show beautifully in the book is how this is kind of dichotomy between the lives that people lived, the native people who lived in the Southwest, and then the conquerors who came, starting with the Spanish, but the Americans, Euro-Americans were definitely part of this too, coming looking for riches or looking for other ways to exploit the landscape, and how they were successful in making the lives of the indigenous people miserable and probably exterminating great amounts of them, but failed in terms of being able to conquer the landscape. I came across this morning again a quote from Irma Ferguson that you have in your introduction, and I love the beginning. It says, "The arid Southwest has always been too strong, too indomitable for most people. Those who can stand it have had to learn that man does not modify this country. It transforms him deeply." Do you think that that's kind of the core of what the Southwest is about?
Well, yeah, the enduring power of its aridity is a major theme in its history. To a large degree, you know, Anglo-America has tamed the Southwest. You think about the great plumbing of the Colorado River and the hydraulic civilization that we've built. But it's a temporary taming. It's not going to survive the centuries. We can be pretty sure of that. And the style of living that will survive the centuries could be quite different from that which we pursue today.
When we can no longer afford air conditioning, for one thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think about Phoenix's terrific vulnerability to a breakdown in the grid during the summer. I mean, the heat stress that people would go through would be as awful a horror as the flooding of Hurricane Harvey.
Well, actually, and before we get back to what your book is about, and I don't want to diminish that because it is a very impressive book, and I think about some stuff that most Americans don't think about. But I'm thinking that the lessons of the two hurricanes so far, and who knows what's going to happen with the ones that are coming, in both cases, but particularly in Texas, it seems like the big lesson is how much our pollution comes back to haunt us when we flood the way Houston was flooded in that whole area. In Florida, it's that you can't live without air conditioning when you try to build huge population centers in places that, well, in Florida, it's not just hot like Phoenix, it's also really, really humid. So we're looking at, it looks like maybe the beginning of the end of civilization as we know it in this hemisphere. I wonder if you can make analogies back to some of the lessons that you see in the canyons and the canyon landscapes and developments that are unearthed in the Southwest, for instance, like Ocone or like the Canyon de Chelly.
Well, I think it's dangerous to draw too direct a comparison because of technological differences between societies. But certainly, one of the great questions of Southwestern archaeology is that after the Chaco drought, when Chaco Canyon, the great civilization of Chaco Canyon, seems to have dissolved and people dispersed, people nevertheless stayed in the same region. A century or so later, when the great civilization of the Mesa Verdean fluorescence similarly succumbed to drought, people left the region. Everybody went away. What was different? And the difference may be that in the later drought cycle, enormous social conflict and warfare developed. And that's one of the things that rattles around the back of my alleged mind when I think about environmental stress, and that is how environmental stresses cause fracturing along the fault lines that run through any society. And if the society breaks down, then that magnifies the destructive power of the environmental stress enormously. I think, frankly, that we're seeing that these days in Syria, that there is an underlying environmental cause behind the Syrian civil war, and that we see it in the South Sudan today, in Darfur and neighboring regions. Once upon a time, I listened to Bill McKibben give a great talk on climate change, and after it, a woman asked him, well, if it's coming, what do we do to prepare for it? And Bill said, live in a strong community. And the woman pursued the question quite logically and asked, how do you find a strong community? And Bill's answer was, you don't, you build it.
So I'm curious, let's talk a little bit about Canyon de Chelly and why, what happened there and why people seem to have stuck around even after that civilization kind of had to dissolve.
Well, the Canyon de Chelly has gone through several cycles of settlement. It appears that in the diaspora from the Mesa Verdean region, when people left in the 13th century, some of those people came to Canyon de Chelly and stayed for a while, and they built the fantastic cliff dwellings in the cliff faces of Canyon de Chelly, which enchant us all to see them today. But if you think about it, those cliff dwellings are, in a way, a landscape of fear. The only reason people would live in such a demanding location instead of down on the canyon floor was because they feared violence if they lived on the canyon floor. Those cliff dwellings are defensive. Well, the people who occupied those cliff dwellings eventually left, and according to strong Hopi traditions, many, if not all of them, wound up going to Hopi. Canyon de Chelly, however, is still occupied by Native Americans, and the people who are there now are the Diné, the Navajo, who moved west from under pressure from Spanish and eventually Anglo pressures, and moved their homeland westward until Canyon de Chelly was essentially at the center of Dineta, the homeland of the Diné people. And so even today, Canyon de Chelly is occupied, I think, by some 80 families for all or part of the year. And right near the mouth of the canyon is Chinle, one of the major really urban centers of the Navajo Reservation. It's another great example of cultural survival and longevity in the Southwest.
Well, we're talking this morning with William DeBries, who just came out with a new book that he co-authored with actually a deceased writer, and we'll talk a little bit about that collaboration and when we get back. This book was co-written by David Weber and William DeBries, is called First Impressions, A Reader's Journey to Iconic Places of the American Southwest. But for a moment, we're going to talk with Liz and Will about supporting KABU and keeping us from becoming a forgotten iconic place, helping us stay very vital into the future.
Thanks, Barbara. My name is Liz. I'm here with Will. And the way we remain relevant and not become a forgotten memory is by community support. 877-500-5266. You are the community in community-supported radio. And that might sound a little strange because community is sort of a plural or collective notion, and you're thinking of yourself, well, I'm just an individual. You are not just an individual. You are a vital part of our listening audience, and now we'd like you to take that next step and become a vital part of our sustaining and supporting audience. 877-500-5266, or go online to kboo.fm and become a member that way. Barbara, did we have some books, some copies of the book as a thank you gift?
I believe we've got two copies of First Impressions, A Reader's Journey to Iconic Places of the American Southwest by David Weber and William DeBries, who's my guest this morning. And they are available for, I'm not exactly sure what the dollar amount is. You probably have that up front.
We don't, actually. That's why I was asking.
But we can work it out.
We'll work it out. Yeah, whatever they're available for, it's a book not to be missed.
It's an incredible book. Actually, I first was reading the proof before the actual book came out, and it was missing a very vital part of it, which are these plates in the middle of the book that are these amazing somebody's phone is going anyway. There are these amazing paintings and other kinds of graphics showing this landscape, and besides the great images, there's also this beautiful writing by the two authors. And I highly recommend reading the book, and you can get a copy of that book right now by calling
877-500-5266.
Thank
that
you very
number
much.
Again. 877-500-5266.
I admit that was my phone. I apologize, but it's my birthday, so I don't want to miss any phone.
Happy birthday, Will. I wanted to interject that I was coming home from the coast the other day and listening to one of my other favorite community radio stations, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, KMUN, and they were having a pledge drive. I was listening to it with fascination. And a woman that I know who was pitching started talking about how pledge drives are really celebrations of the community.
Oh, yeah.
And I
Absolutely.
Brought that home with me. I want to share that with you guys. So what does
that
mean?
So your interviewer, the person you were interviewing just quoted, the William DeBois just quoted the thing that how do you find a good community or a great community? You don't.
You don't.
You build
one.
Yeah, and that's what you folks are doing when you call up and dial us at 877-500-5266. You make the community. You don't find it. You make it. You are the community.
How do you build that community? Pick up your phone right now. 877-500-5266. You can get a copy of the book. And we're going to go back to the program in just a moment. In fact, just about right now. Barbara, over to you.
Well, thanks a whole lot, Liz and Will. And we'll be talking to you in a little while. We're talking this morning with Bill DeBries, who's a longtime resident of his acquired homeland, the Southwest, and he lives in northern New Mexico. And he co-authored a book called First Impressions, A Reader's Journey to Iconic Places of the American Southwest with David Weber. Bill, I wanted to talk a bit about this unusual collaboration. And you said in your introduction that it'd be very hard to tell, you know, which voice was whose. And so I spent the whole book trying to figure out what was your writing and what was David's writing. And a couple of times I think I figured out what was your writing because I've read so many of your books. But how did you start, I mean, how did this collaboration come about?
Well, David was a longtime friend of mine, especially from the year, the academic year 1999 to 2000. I had a fellowship at SMU to do a book on John Wesley Powell, and David, it was at an institute that David had founded called the Clements Center for Southwest Studies. David was a senior professor at SMU for 35 or 40 years, and we became very good friends. This book, First Impressions, is a book that David started. The concept behind it is his. The selection of the places in it is his. But the collaboration is unusual in that we never worked on the book at the same time. David was working along on the book when he was became ill, and he passed away in 2010. And a year later, his widow, Carol Weber, asked me if I would consider finishing the book. And I had actually talked with David a little bit about the book while he was still alive and was intrigued by the concept and thought it was really engaging and interesting. But I never had any idea that I would, you know, put pen to paper in service to that idea. But when Carol asked me, I thought about it and said, well, yes. And so the book was about halfway done when David passed away. And so I think we're really pretty much equal authors in this. And I'm honored to have been able to bring to completion something that David started. Non-academics will not know that David was the premier borderlands historian of our time, and he is the author of something like 26 or 27 different books, and has received the Legion of Merit from the nation of Spain. He's one of the most honored historians of our time in the United States. So it's a wonderful thing to be able to complete his work.
Well, I find it's a very intriguing form for a book because it's kind of like a tour guide, only it's a tour guide through history.
Yes.
And do you know what his intention was when he's writing it, besides just turning people on to these really amazing places, of which I would say most people who don't live in the Southwest would only be familiar with a handful of the spots, like Tucson, yeah. Santa Fe, the Grand Canyon, Mesa Verde, maybe Chaco Canyon. But beside that, did he have some other vision, do you think?
Yeah, part of his vision was to put what a historian would call primary sources before a general readership. Now, a primary source is a document that was created at the time of the events it describes. And history, doing real history, usually involves going back to primary sources and examining them closely. But most of those primary sources, the military reports and the letters from explorers back to their bosses and things like that, are found in archives and are difficult for the general public to access. But David, ever the teacher, ever the professor, wanted to get these wonderful primary documents in front of a general readership, and he thought the way to do it was to talk about iconic places and the first impressions of the non-natives who came to them. Those first impressions are recorded in those primary documents, which are sometimes written documents, most of the time written documents, but sometimes also paintings, drawings, photographs, and so forth. And so First Impressions is a book of those first impressions that the first non-natives recorded when they went to these fantastic places.
Now, have you visited all these places yourself?
I have been to pretty to all of them except for Rainbow Bridge, which is...
Hard to get to.
takes some real getting to, yeah. But I was fascinated to write about it and to learn about it. And so it's on my list.
I'm curious how your first impressions stack up against, if you remember your first impressions of each of these places, and how they stack up against the writings that you've gathered in the book.
Oh, pretty much I do remember my first impressions of all those places. And sometimes my first impressions have been completely turned upside down by my later experience. I remember when I first came to the Southwest driving a road just north of Santa Fe, I thought the pinon and juniper hills covered this, by these scrawny, what we call PJ, these scrawny, not quite trees, growing out of the pink gravels of those hills were quite ugly. And today, I regard them as among the most beautiful landscapes I know. So that's a complete flip of my own personal aesthetic response to those lands. And in first impressions, people will see that in many instances, cultures flipped in their response to places. The first Americans coming to Santa Fe, for instance, the first North Americans, regarded the place as a dusty hovel, not an attractive place at all. But even before the city had cleaned itself up, other Anglos coming a little bit later began to detect a kind of charm and a seductive exoticness about the place. And so we see that in their first impressions.
Well, we also seem, it seems like you go through this whole transition from when these lands were inhabited strictly by indigenous people to then being taken over by Spaniards and there being kind of a hybrid culture that was Mexican. And then the Southwest was taken from Mexico and became American, or U.S. American. And that each time there's like a sense, the first impression is of a different kind of exoticness in a way. And I get that sense particularly when North Americans were traveling by train to Santa Fe in the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, each culture has its own sort of period of shock and surprise in encountering a place so different from where its people had come from. And so that's re-experiencing that is part of the plan of first impressions. The idea that this is like a time machine that allows us to go back and experience the emotions of the people who had those first impressions sometimes centuries ago, and to see the land through their eyes with their measure of surprise and maybe disdain or charm or whatever. But history is never a smooth, straight road. It twists and turns, and a lot of those turns are quite a lot of fun for us to experience in the present.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about the Southwest, and certainly the first time or the first few times I was there, is that more so than any other part of the United States, it feels really different. You feel like you're in a foreign country. And the only other part of the United States I might have felt that way is New Orleans, which also feels like it's really not an American city. But it's surrounded by a landscape that there's a lot of America that is that kind of landscape. But the Southwest is so starkly different. And I wonder how that informs the relationship that people have had to the land and then the relationship between the conquerors and the people who have made this kind of agreement with the landscape.
Well, one of the great things about the Southwest is not just the spectacular landscape, which is just surpassingly beautiful in almost every quarter, but the enduring cultural diversity within the region. People in New Mexico are fond of talking about three cultures, Anglo, Hispanic, and Indian. Well, those three are strong, but there are more besides. Asian population, all kinds, so many other people, and the native population is not just one tribe, but many tribes. And so this feeling of diversity, of non-homogeneity, I think, is in the blood of everyone in the region, and it touches everyone who comes to the region, and that's part of what makes it feel so different from what feels to me kind of a homogenized society in most of the rest of the United States, except, as you point out, in real mixing places in some of our cities like New Orleans and frankly, New York City as well, I think.
Actually, yeah, I was to think that New York City was part of the Third World back when it was having some very hard times in the late 70s and early 80s. Actually, I had a friend who was living in the East Village, and she would point out the kids playing at the fire hydrants, which are opened every summer, and that was even being done before New York went through its really hard times at that time. And she said that the fire hydrant sort of served as a village pump. And it was an interesting kind of take, because you've kind of looked at these people who, they did have indoor plumbing, sort of, but that they needed a fire hydrant to cool off was an indication of the difference between that and living in Phoenix, where you had your swimming pool.
Right, right, yeah.
Well, I also think it's kind of interesting to look at our takes. I mean, you and I are both from the Northeast and grew up in very, very wet climates. And the... for a lot of people who live with 40 inches or more of rain a year, there's something almost frightening about the desert. And I know when I first moved to the West, and I, unlike you, I settled in the Northwest in an area almost as wet as where I grew up. And the first few times I spent time in the Southwest desert, I was panicked to be without water. And I wonder, what did you have a similar response when you first came there, like that there was just not enough water around to make you feel secure?
Well, I don't think I was smart enough to respond at that level. But when the place where I live in the Southwest is, it's dry, but it's not desert. I'm up in really the southern Rocky Mountains, and my little farm where I'm talking to you from is at almost 8,000 feet of altitude. So we get some pretty good rain in the summer monsoons, and a good deal of snow in the winter, at least if it's a good winter. So it's not totally desiccated, but you get used to it. And you know, these days I go back to a more humid part of the country, and it feels fairly oppressive to me.
I know the feeling. I was just back in Florida a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, right.
Well, we're talking this morning with Bill DeBuys, who's co-author of a book called First Impressions, A Reader's Journey to Iconic Places of the American Southwest. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. And we're going to talk now with Will and Liz, who are going to tell you why you should become a member of KBOO, because we're in the midst of our fall pledge drive. And this is our opportunity to celebrate our community and for you to celebrate with us by becoming a member of KBOO.
I'll lead off if you like. That's right. And it's our great pleasure to be here. We have two copies of this fascinating book about the nature of the arid desert, and it's certainly not arid up here, but we have the American Southwest is a phenomenal landscape, and it is changing, and it will continue to change, and there's an influx of people, no matter who they are or where they're from, but it's all part of community. That's the diversity of our the human existence, and you can celebrate that by picking up the phone and dialing 877-500-5266, because we're all part of this community, and you folks out there listening right now are part of the KBOO community. But you can actually make this happen. You can be a radical and participating member of the community by dialing 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. I'm sitting here with my friend Liz, and we're both here to help raise money for this phenomenal radio station.
That's right.
You wouldn't find these kind of shows anywhere else.
That's right. And, you know, Will is such a fan of KBOO and of the diverse programming that we offer that he even volunteered to come in on his birthday.
Happy birthday.
Way to go,
me.
Will. Happy birthday. Thank you so much. So that's just one example of one volunteer giving of his time.
And I got rained on.
And he got rained on. And you know, so clearly Will is dedicated. We know that a lot of you make a point of listening to Locus Focus every week. Barbara has been producing this program. How many years have you been on the air, Barbara?
Well, I've been on the air since
the earth cooled, right?
1978.
Yeah.
But I started doing the show as an afternoon call-in show in the aftermath of the Persian Gulf War in 91.
Okay, so and Locus Focus has been on the air going on 30 years almost.
Oh, it's only been 20.
Only 26. Okay, well, okay, fair enough. Either way, Barbara has been tirelessly researching and reporting and investigating the topics that we know that you think are important. And now's the time to show your support for Barbara, for Locus Focus, for all of the diverse public affairs programming that you hear on KBOO. 877-500-5266. We've only got... We've only got two copies of that book, First Impressions by William DeVries, of Barbara's guest today. And that book can be yours for a $60 contributing membership. But you've got to call now because they're going to go fast. 877-500-5266. What was that, Will?
I was just going to say, and also, if you're a dog lover, Barbara Bernstein has a wonderful, really cute dog that I know because I used to volunteer on Mondays, and that dog is great. So if you're a dog lover, please call up right now and pledge your support.
When my dog was younger, she used to come during pledge drives, but now she's a little too old. She gets a little freaked out with all the energy here.
I know how she feels.
But if you come usually on Monday, if you come on Mondays after the pledge drive is over, Michelle, who's our receptionist now on Mondays, she watches Karina while I'm doing the show. So aww, you can come in and meet Karina and pet her. She loves to greet people.
Karina, Karina, care where you've been so long.
Actually, I was one time driving through Idaho listening to Pledge Drive on uh-huh. the public radio station in Boise.
You really make a point of listening to other radio stations' membership drives,
yeah,
don't
well,
you?
Well, if you travel around a lot, you often get them.
It's true.
So they were doing, so there was a call out to dogs to pledge to the station, and they actually got a bunch of calls.
That's awesome.
So I tried it. It didn't really work here, but if anybody's dog would like to become a member who listens to Locus Focus regularly, give a call right now at 877-500-5266.
Or cats, because we are not dog-centric here at KBOO. You know, cats, iguanas, pot-bellied pigs.
Chickens.
Yeah, but hey, lots of chickens in Portland. That's right. But, I know we're joking around here, but we're actually talking about something very, very serious, which is about the community support that is needed to keep programs like Locus Focus on the air. You are a member of the community just by listening. That's one level of membership. It's a rather passive level because you're just consuming the radio. Now's your time to actively step up and become a member at the next level, which is to support the radio station that means so much to you. 877-4255. 500-5266. I was picking up on something that Barbara, that your guest said about the non-homogeneity of the Southwest and about the incredible cultural diversity of that part of the country. And that is really a lot of what makes KBOO such a unique place too. We are non-homogeneous. We are full of diversity of all kinds in terms of cultures and races and genders and religions and ages and experiences. And it's what makes KBOO such an amazing place. We are so diverse and we offer programming that spans the spectrum. And we know that that's a value that matters to you. So show your support right now, 877-500-5266. I want to give a thank you to Dan from Southwest Portland. Thank you, Dan, for renewing your membership.
Thank you, Dan.
And thanks also to James from Salem renewing his membership.
Thanks, Jimbo.
Thanks. And, you know, we've been hearing a lot from Portlanders and Salemers today. Salemers. And I'd like to hear from folks out in Hood River. I'd like to hear from folks up in Longview, Washington. I'd like to hear from folks down in Philomath and Corvallis, where we are heard loud and clear.
And don't forget Enterprise, Oregon.
Don't forget. And, you know, and because we stream our audio live all over the world at KBOO.FM, you can call us from anywhere or click on our website from anywhere.
I actually had a call one time from San Luis Obispo.
Well, there you go.
I know who it was. But, I mean, so everybody who's listening in California right now.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of commonality. We're all experiencing massive wildfires across the West. So let's all, in support of like our landscape, in support of dealing with climate change so that we can deal rationally with what's happening on the landscape, give a call right now at 877-500-5266.
That's go right. There's too much water down south, and there's too much fire up north.
We got to find some way to bring a mix to these two elements.
You know, if we could just truck all that water that's been flooding Houston, and all that water that's been flooding Florida, and truck it over to the arid West, You know, it would be an amazing thing, and the whole eco and biodiversity of the West would be transformed.
Well, actually, there were plans to take water from the Great Lakes and from the Columbia River and to feed the water, the unquenchable thirst of Southern California.
Well,
we shouldn't really talk about that too much.
No, I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about the idea that when there's excess, that we could get a whole bunch of trucks together and just, you know, pump up the excess water that's flooding the streets and take it to where it's needed. I'm not talking about draining the aquifers here, okay? But just so we're all clear on what we are talking about, what we're really talking about is your support of your community radio station.
That's right.
KBOO-FM 877-500-5266. We have a goal for this hour of $300, and we need your help to make that goal. So if we had three people call up and pledge $100, that would do it. If we had,
and you could spread that over like an entire year.
If we had six people calling up and becoming members at $50, that would do it. You know, the amount isn't important. What's important is your support. 877-500-5266 or online anywhere on planet Earth at KBOO.FM. Thanks so much.
Thanks for talking with us, Will and Liz, and we'll be back talking to you again before the hour's over. And we're talking this morning with William DeBuise, who's co-author of First Impressions, A Reader's Journey to Iconic Places of the American Southwest. While I was just hearing Liz and Will talking, I was thinking, Bill, about the when a community experiences lots of people coming through it and transforming it, and Portland has been experienced this for, well, probably as long as I've been living here, but it's in the last 10 or 15 years, a lot of new people have come here, a lot of diversity. I mean, I think the city is way more diverse than it used to be, and there's a lot of people feeling threatened because the city's changing, and changing in ways that they don't like. So it's kind of diversity is a mixed blessing, because besides getting some great, fascinating multiculturalism, we've been starting to get rich white people coming, which is really changing the face of the city. I'm wondering if you see a parallel with like the different cultures that have filtered through the Southwest and have like uprooted more indigenous cultures or more established cultures, and how the Southwest has balanced keeping all these people together in a way.
Yeah, balanced or not balanced. I mean, the record is not spotless here, but you know, Santa Fe has gone through cycles of this kind of change. During the 80s and 90s, it was tens of thousands of people moved into Santa Fe from other parts of the country, and this is always a problem for a community. If the influx is slow, then the community has a chance to acculturate and absorb the new people. And if the influx is too great, then the new people don't really absorb the values of their adopted home, but tend to recreate the places where they came from in that new place. And that creates a lot of stress for the old-timers in the new place. So, I don't think there's any magic formula for dealing with this. The past certainly doesn't indicate that there was. In the archaeological record of the Southwest, it looks as though a lot of the strife in the Mesa Verdean region probably resulted from people moving in to that fertile region from other places that had experienced the early onset of either cold spells or drought, and such that the people couldn't sustain their lives there anymore, and they moved to the Mesa Verdean region, and the influx of those people created all kinds of stresses on the existing society of the Mesa Verdean region.
And they all
so
left.
We go through this over and over.
I'm thinking, I mean, I've talked to a number of people who've moved to Portland in the last few years who came from Southern California and other parts of the Southwest, and I would consider them climate refugees because it's just getting too hot and dry for them there, and
yeah,
they're freaking out. And so people in the Northwest are freaking out because where's there going to be room for everybody? And then on top of that, I think another thing, and I wonder if there's archaeological records in the Southwest that might shed light on this. We had such a strange summer here in the Northwest where it started out being very cold and very wet for a very long period. And then all of a sudden, and that was beautiful. And then it got really, really hot and dry. And so what was projected to be a very low level fire year because there was so much moisture and so much snowpack turned into the worst fire year we've had. I'm one of the worst since I've lived here, and probably one of the worst in written history. And it's something, the very, very wet ground dried out really, really fast. And I don't know if there's any parallels of that happening in the Southwest, but it seems like we're looking at a climate regime that we don't recognize and we don't know what to do with, and we really don't even know how to prepare for. I wonder if the consequences of Mesa Verde is something we can look at around the country and wonder if this is in our future unless we can figure out something else really fast.
Well, there's no question but that in the history of the Southwest, climate changes have been a main propelling force of human social events. There have been a lot of climate perturbations in the deep history of the Southwest, mega droughts that have altered the survivability of various cultures. Drawing direct parallels to the present is probably a poor idea, but there's no question but that with climate change, it's like what the stock prospectuses say. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. As you've described the last several months in your part of the country, it's unlike anything anyone might have expected based on previous conditions. And so suddenly you're in a new situation. We're going to be seeing that again and again. Certainly Hurricane Harvey shows us that the powerful extreme weather of the present can produce astonishing results.
Unfortunately, we still have some people in office who deny that climate change is a human-caused phenomenon. And I guess this is something you and I keep coming back to talking about every time, because this is what's facing us. And I wonder, I'm wondering if you have any more hope maybe than the last time we talked about there being a change of mindset that these experiences, whether it's the incredible force of the hurricanes and the flooding in the Southeast or the amazing fires in the West, if this is starting to change other people, maybe not Trump and maybe not Pruitt, but other people who matter, who might be looking and going, maybe we really do have to figure out how to make some changes.
Well, there's no question but that the denialism of our time in the Republican Party is one of the greatest tragedies of this period of life on the planet. Just no question, full stop. It's not just Trump, it's the entire Republican Party. There are some signs that some of that party's leaders are coming around, but they're dragging their feet and they're moving so slowly. They are one of the most dangerous forces on the planet today in that they are retarding a planetary response to this great challenge. And we can only hope that the American electorate makes a big change in 2018 and again in 2020, and that we get busy with the kind of work that we should be doing, because the fate of human society globally is really at stake here.
I was talking with some people yesterday who were saying, well, we could probably, we'll survive Trump. I mean, he's looking pretty vulnerable in a lot of ways, but can we survive climate change, and can we survive the lack of effort to deal head-on with the realities of climate change for 4 years? And I guess that's a concern a lot of us have, is like we've lost a year already, and we're going to possibly lose three more years. What are we going to be left with in 2020?
Yeah, the window for meaningful action is narrow to begin with, and it's becoming more and more narrow. That's not to say that whenever we get around to it, we will be worth doing, that's for sure. But getting around to it as late as we are means that there's so much change already in the system that we could see fundamental, permanent change to the climate cycles of the planet in a way that is very, very dangerous and very harmful to existing society.
Yeah, I actually had a real kind of eye-opener. I was at the Oregon coast on Friday at one of my favorite beaches, which has two creeks that run through the beach, across the beach, and they're actually sometimes pretty hard to cross without taking your shoes off. And so I crossed the first creek very easily. There was a trickle of water in it, and I got to the second creek, and I looked for it, and I saw that it was ending before the tide line. And this is the first time I've ever seen a creek on the Oregon coast not make it to the ocean. I started thinking about the Colorado River not making it to the Sea of Cortez. And I thought, this was kind of my real wake up of realizing this is what we're facing now. And I wonder if on some global level, I mean, what it takes for people to realize that, yeah, things are really different than they were just even a few years ago.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, even if we ceased emission of all greenhouse gases tomorrow, the climate would still continue changing for at least a generation.
That's a cheery thought. Well, you know, and the last...
There's a cheery thought, huh?
Yeah. But I want to go out, actually, by talking about the Grand Canyon, because that's probably the most iconic of all the landscapes that you describe in the book. And it's also the one that we think of the least about human settlement. And I wanted to talk about the interaction of this immense formation. I mean, I can't even think of a word to really describe the power of the Grand Canyon and its interaction with humans. And the first responses that, I guess it was the Spaniards were the first non-indigenous people to see the Grand Canyon, comparing their response to now when we go and, you know, like the movie Grand Canyon, when you go and you look at the Grand Canyon and it changes your life.
Yeah, well, the Grand Canyon is it's one of my favorite chapters in the book because it's complex in so many ways. The initial story of the discovery of Grand Canyon by Neo-Europeans involves a detachment of Coronado's army in the middle of the 16th century under Lopez de Cardenas going out looking for this great river of the West that they'd heard about from the Hopis, and Hopi men guided them to the brink of the canyon. They took much too long to get there, and they didn't understand why. And when they got to the brink of the canyon, the Hopis told them, oh, there's no way to go down there. Well, of course, the Hopi knew exactly how to get down there. They had many trails that took them down there to sacred sites in the canyon. They were very familiar with the canyon. But they wanted these Spanish guys with swords and horses to have a hard time. They actually hoped that they would die in the desert, and if they didn't, that they'd have such a bad time that they'd never come back. So that's one level of complexity at Grand Canyon. The Spaniards, if they knew they were being conned by the Hopi, they didn't let on in their official dispatches home. But another side to this is that even for Western Anglo-Americans, it took three revolutions, really, a scientific revolution, an aesthetic revolution, and a political revolution to make the canyon grand. Initially, it was seen just as a desert hole. But, and I won't go into all three of those revolutions, but one of them, the scientific revolution, involves the discovery of deep time, that the Earth isn't just 6,000 years old, but that it goes back millions and millions, truly billions of years. And without an understanding of deep time, the geological complexity of Grand Canyon is merely baffling, and people don't understand what it's telling them. It took the discovery of deep time for the Grand Canyon's true reality to become apparent to people, and that's part of what makes it grand.
Well, at this point, we got to cut off today, William, but it's really been great talking to you, and I'm hoping we can still have that conversation about the Colorado River at some time in the near future.
All right, I'd love to do it.
Have you finished writing that book yet that you were working on all summer?
I'm about halfway done.
Okay, well, maybe we can figure out a time when you're free on a Monday morning.
All right, great.
Okay, well, thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
You've been talking with William DeBuise, his co-author of First Impressions, and you're listening to Cable Community Radio here, listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. Now we're going to talk some more with Will and Liz about why you need to become a member of Cable.
That's right. Thank you very much. It's a fascinating conversation, and we do have two volumes of that book available, and I recommend calling up right now at 877-500-5266. Not only are you pledging your support for KBOO Community Radio, but you're also getting a phenomenally interesting book. I've enjoyed this entire conversation. Barbara Bernstein works very hard on these shows and gets incredibly interesting guests. And we can show our gratitude by dialing 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. You can also donate online. It's super simple. You just look us up at kboo.fm. You can stream our radio shows. You can also find all the incredibly interesting podcasts we have available. And you can pledge your support. Isn't that right, Liz?
Absolutely. And when you become a member today, September 18th, your name will be entered into a drawing for relaxation. You'll win 12 passes for an hour-long soak and sauna session at Common Ground Wellness Co-op in Portland. We'll be offering a new prize for every day of the drive, but today's prize is all about soaking in the cool in the hot tub and steaming in the sauna. Give us a call, become a member, or increase your membership, give a gift of a membership to a friend. And that number again is 877-500-5266, or again online at kboo.fm. I've just been told we are down to only one copy left of the book First Impressions by William DeBuise and his co-author about non-native first impressions of the Southwest.
And his co-author's dead, so don't forget that.
I'm not sure why that matters so much.
Well, you might want to buy it.
Okay. Either way, we've only got one copy left of the book, which can be yours for a $60 membership. Again, 877-500-5266. And, you know, the book is a great incentive, and entering into the drawing to win the free passes to Common Ground is also another terrific incentive. But really, the incentive is, or should be, that you care about this program, you care about this kind of programming, and that you appreciate the important, in-depth investigative journalism that KBOO offers you every day. Every day. You hear stuff here you're not going to hear anywhere else. And we know that that matters to you because you're tuned in right now. So show your support. Take that step from just listening to becoming an active, financial, contributing, sustaining member of your community radio station. 877-500-5266. Don't forget, we've got one copy of that book, First
unique.
Impressions. It's unique. It's your opportunity. We've got an opportunity for you to win soaks at Common Ground. And if you've never been there, it's a really terrific place, and you will emerge warm and happy and relaxed for sure. And safe and secure in the knowledge that you have done your part to support your community radio station. What's the deal with it being a community station anyway? I mean, why does that make it any different from, say, a commercial radio station?
Well, it's not commercials.
Or even a public radio station. The difference is that in a community radio station model, everything is done by members of the community. All the voices you hear on the radio are of volunteers who are volunteering their time here at KBOO. We have a very small, tirelessly, effortlessly working paid staff, but we have about 500 active volunteers that bring all of this programming to you. And so, you know, 80% of our financial input, our inlay, our budget. Our revenue, thank you, comes from individual people just like you, the folks like you who are listening right now with your coffee cup in your hand or your dog on your leash or sitting at your desk or whatever you're doing right now.
But or driving like a maniac down the highway.
Please don't drive like a maniac down the highway. And you are driving and you want to become a member, please pull over and do it safely. But please, now's the time. 877-500-5266. 5266. Will, you're dying to say something here. I can just tell.
I'm always dying to say something. I've always got something to say. It may not be worth listening to, but I've got something to say.
But this is worth listening to.
And what's worth listening to? It's 877-500-5266. It's very easy, but very important, because free speech costs money. And I know you're listening there because it's important information that we're giving you, and wonderful music, and you wouldn't get it if you didn't listen to KBOO. And you can listen to KBOO because you pledge your support by dialing 877-500-5266.
Or go online anywhere on the planet for free at kboo.fm. Become a member that way.
Or become a volunteer. There's always the opportunities to volunteer here.
That's right. When you become a member of KBOO, you offer yourself the opportunity to become a volunteer here at the station, learn how to create radio programs of your own, learn how to be on the air, learn how to produce off the air, join our board of governors and our board, and help us shape the future of KBOO. We've been on the air for 50 years. As of next year, we want to be on the air for another 50, but it's going to take your support right now. 877-500-5266, and thank you so much.
That's right.
Thank you, Liz, and thank you, Will. We've been talking with William DeBuys today, who's co-author of First Impressions, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, my guest is toxicologist Emily Manassan, author of Natural Defense, Enlisting Bugs and Germs to Protect Our Food and Health. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Mike and Primo and Robbie Robertson called Peyote Healing. Thanks for listening, and help our pledge drive. Call 877-500-5266 and become a member of KBOO now.
Watching you, a day, oh, my, yeah, you. Watching you, a day.